never wants to change themselves.
93.3 WMMR, everything that rocks. And Pierre Robert, the song is a great one. It's called Do You Really Want It? The band is Nothing More, and they are our guests this afternoon who hail from the fine village of San Antonio, Texas. That is where their drummer at the time, he's now their front man, but then he was their drummer, Johnny, met Mark. Mark played guitar, and I believe they met, if this information is correct, at a church camp. They officially formed the group in 2003. Then Daniel joined in 2004. There have been a lot of rotating members throughout the years, independent albums that were released, but the latest album is very cool, and it's called The Stories We Tell Ourselves. It arrived in September of last year. They're in town this evening bringing their rather spectacular stage show to the TLA on South Street. So great pleasure to welcome Johnny Hawkins and Daniel Oliver of Nothing More to MMR. Greetings.
Hey.
What's going on, Pierre?
Nice to have you here. Welcome.
So and that nice information was pretty spot on, just to verify.
Okay.
Yeah. San Antonio is more of like a pueblo, though, than a... I forget what you called it, but...
Well, I call it a fine village.
Fine village.
Every city a fine village.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you could be from Camden, New Jersey. Fine village of Camden, New
fine
Jersey.
Fine village.
You could be from... You know, New York City, the fine village. You know, it's always a village and it's always fine. It's so nice to have you guys here. The album, if I understand correctly, I guess you guys have your own recording space and it's a house. And if I understood this part correctly, you would each go to different rooms and write music and then collaborate on it and then send it off to your producer, Will Hoffman. Is that how it worked in terms of the coming together of the songs?
That's about half right. It's kind of like that on the self-titled record. It was more that way, where we lived in a house together and Dan was in the garage area welding things and working on our live show gear and show pieces.
Yeah.
And I'd be upstairs in the control room, which was basically my bedroom that had a studio desk next to it. And I'd be recording or mixing or something, and then Mark would many times be down in the other room, the dining room, which was actually our rehearsal room with Paul at the time. And so we had kind of this operating little factory of a house on that record, but on our latest record, The Stories We Tell Ourselves, it was done a little more mobily. I actually had my studio in my apartment, and Ben and Mark set up kind of a studio in that same house. And then our manager, Will Hoffman, was in Austin, and we'd bounce things back and forth with him. So it's a very confusing process to describe, but, you know, a lot of moving parts.
Well, I love when I read an album credits. You can always learn something about a band. You describe some of the production facilities, but then you also add in, as well as various tour buses, backstage dressing rooms, and what you call Johnny's closet.
Yeah.
Curious what Johnny's closet is or was, or what you did there.
Day one of us recording ourselves, which started with me manipulating a loophole in my college funds. Basically, I found a way to take a course that I could justify all the required materials to be studio equipment, and I just poured all the money into all this gear. And that's when we started on our The Few Not Fleeting record. And the very first time we recorded, I basically used my closet as a vocal booth, because at the time that was all we had to work with. And then ever since then, any amalgamation of my studio setup has been called Johnny's Closet.
Like that.
Yeah.
And the old saying, necessity is the mother of invention.
It is.
Yeah. We're all about manipulating money however we can get it. Yeah. If Johnny breaking into his grandparents' trust for college, you know, we won a Warped Tour Battle of the Bands and got $10,000 in Guitar Center credit, sold it all, you know, for kind of like 80 cents on the dollar kind of thing. You know, we had a van running on vegetable oil for a while, so we were stealing grease from Chinese restaurants.
Hey, you know,
that's whatever. That's the spirit of rock and roll, though. Whatever
it
takes.
You know, the best one, though, I got to say, is an old manager that we used to work with. He co-managed with our manager, Will. And he told us this story where when he was in high school, he's graduating his senior year. And you know how you write all these thank you notes to, you know, people who attended your, you know, little party or whatever, congratulated you. Well, he wrote all these fake thank you notes, and he went into a phone book and just found all the doctors and lawyers and wrote thank you notes banking on the fact that they'd probably not have enough time to remember whose kid this was.
Yeah.
And they all sent him like $100 checks. And he made like a few thousand dollars just sending people fake thank you notes.
Wow. Brilliant.
Well, at one point, didn't you have a Kickstarter fund? I mean, if so, how much did you make from it? And was it helpful getting you over that particular bridge?
Yeah. We actually crowdsourced the album that 11/7 picked up.
Huh.
So yeah, we were still independent at that time.
Was that the self-titled album?
Just the self-titled.
More, yeah.
Yeah. Yes. That album. While we were self-producing it, Red Bull Records was actually real hot on us, and we thought we were going to end up with them. And no label had been interested in us before. We'd just gotten a bunch of no's. And then Red Bull broke our hearts, and we're like, screw it, let's just kickstart this thing. And you know, we decided that album, like, if it didn't do it, nothing would, you know, because we'd been kicking for 10 years now. But, you know, we did a good job. 11/7 picked it up as is, didn't change anything, you know, turned around and released it. And now here we are.
Did you make enough? I mean, was it enough to actually carry you through that particular crisis?
Yeah, it was. It was. I think the total was 15 grand.
Cool.
You know,
For a baby band or a young band that's trying to, you know, break through, anything like that is really helpful.
Oh, it's great. It's great. Yeah. And, you know, even though it was self-produced, there's still just so many expenses along with it, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it did the job and we did it. So
we're speaking with Nothing More. They're at the TLA tonight, Daniel Oliver and Johnny Hawkins. And I think a lot of bands learn a lot. You know, we said baby band and young band. People are still just becoming familiar with you with this latest record, even though you've been around for a while, which is a part of your, you know, mission to continue to turn other people onto your music. But in the process, I was looking at all the different people you've opened for, everyone from 30 Seconds to Mars, Chevelle, Five Finger Death Punch, Hell Yeah, Volbeat, Shinedown, Disturbed. And I'm wondering what you learn from those bands. Hopefully they treat you nicely along the way. Some bands don't treat their opening bands nicely, but I'm vibing that most of these guys did, and what you get from that. There's a big silence in the room.
Yeah.
That means
over
is
all the tours,
those bands treated us like S.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, we won't say it because we're nice and diplomatic.
Yeah. Most bands have actually treated us pretty well. And we try to treat other bands to the best of our ability. You know, there's this mixture of trying to be really accommodating and loving and caring towards bands that are in a place that you remember being very difficult, you know, to make it and fight your way up the ranks. And then at the same time, also respecting kind of the paying your dues, you know, a lot of times. Like when a band, I think, is really respectful of that and very like overly has a lot of gratitude and thankfulness, we go overboard to like make sure they're taken care of and like give them extra things and do whatever, you know. But then the bands that feel entitled, you know, we make sure to shut that down as quick as possible because we had to pay our dues. Everybody did, you know, everybody had to be there. But you know, when you're starting out, you don't really know that. You don't know what's where your place is.
You know, when we played this one random festival in a Mexican border town in Texas with Night Ranger, and they taught me that you could still look great even in your late 50s. Those guys still had six packs. It was incredible.
Well, I mean, I think if music does anything for you, it keeps you young. I often reference Bruce Springsteen, who was crowd surfing at 66, running out into the stadium or an arena hall that was packed, up into a ramp halfway through the floor audience, singing Hungry Heart as he's running, and then falls back with a live mic, a wireless mic, onto the audience. The audience crowd surfs him while he's singing Hungry Heart up to the stage where he gets up on stage and finishes it. And after that show, and then on that same tour, he came back a year later and played the stadium, the baseball stadium here, for 4 hours. And he's 66 years old. And then I see the Stones, and Mick Jagger is 72 and 73, and those bands are sounding great. Mm-hmm. One thing if you're going through the motions, but if you're nailing it, it proves to me that, number one, you can sound great at any age, and number two, you never have to act your age.
Yeah. Oh, very true.
That's awesome.
I want to play a song from this record that I really quite like, and I think it showcases your voice in a really nice way, Johnny. It's called Still in Love. It's the 10th track on the album. What would you say about this?
Man, I'm glad you picked that one out. Yeah, me too. When we went into the writing process of this record, I was going through a really rough time in a relationship that at the time I think had been about 8 years together with this girl. And I met her the day my mom died. So there was kind of a bond there that was built in a very dark time, and psychologically, emotionally, very complicated in later years, because I think it probably should have ended sooner, but there would have been a lot of guilt, you know, associated with that, because it was kind of just the nature of how we met each other and when and who this person was to me at that time. But we started going through rough times, and I think both kind of came to the conclusion, you know, we started seeing the truth that we were probably better off not being together, and it was toxic. And so ended up going through a separation and then a divorce through the process of recording this record. And Still in Love was kind of in the heart of that, because even though I knew she wasn't the person I needed to be with for the rest of my life, still cared for her entirely. So it was very mixed feelings. So that's kind of where that one was born.
Well, let's play it. It's just a really great song. I want folks to hear it on 93.3 WMMR. This is Nothing More, and they're in town tonight. That is a great song from our guests this afternoon, Nothing More. It's called Still in Love, and it is from their latest album, which came out last September, The Stories We Tell Ourselves. They're at the TLA tonight. And we have the pleasure of the company of Johnny Hawkins on lead vocals, Daniel Oliver on bass and keyboards and backing vocals. And everyone talks about the show. Now, I have not seen the show, but I have seen some utterly mind-boggling video of various performances of Nothing More. And they're spectacular, to say the least. One I came across recently, I don't know when it was done. Daniel, you talked in our first segment about being in the garage welding or making stuff for the stage show. Mm-hmm. And there's some concert where it looks like you had created a rig that you could insert your bass into that almost made it, in a way, a standing bass. And yet the bass was able to rotate. So you don't come up and play it like a normal bass. You start tapping it and you're making these amazing sounds on it, and you're doing a solo that sounds nothing like a bass solo, and it's brilliant. And then Johnny comes around on the other side and you both are playing this bass together and then flipping it, and it flips around and it comes around. Is that relatively recent, or is that a while back?
You know, we've had that bass solo for quite a while now, probably 3 years.
Forgive my ignorance, but I've never seen you guys live, and I just thought, that's amazing.
Yeah, no, and we've been doing like a bass solo, a multi-man bass solo for, you know, about a decade now. That was kind of one of the first big stabs.
And I have to stop you, because bass solos can be very painful.
Oh, they can.
I'm sorry, with no disrespect, but...
That was actually one of the first things Johnny said whenever I joined the band, like in 04, you know. It's like, oh, yeah, solos are just solos now, you know? So it's like, well, yeah, let's do something different. And that's kind of the spirit behind the show is, you know, we're musicians, we're artists, quote unquote, you know, let's be creative about it. And over the years, we've done some cheesy things, you know, wearing pots and pans and trash can suits and stuff on stage. But, you know, we feel like we've gotten good at it. And really, like, a lot of the spirit behind all the steel work is... You know, you go and see a band and you hear a lot of people say, like, wow, the energy on stage. And when you see, like, a really active band, there is this energy, even if it's just a guy, you know, jumping up and slamming the guitar neck down. And so the spirit of that was to, like, actually have, like take that energy level to something even more grandiose, where there is, you know, about 80 pounds of steel, you know, doing a 720 and locking inverted, you know, and then it's all coming together and continuing to be musicians, you know, on this kind of circus sideshow thing.
But, well, it starts with the music. David Lee Roth used to call the extras tricks, which I liked, because it augments the music. It makes it three-dimensional. It makes it different from what you hear on the record.
Yeah.
But, Johnny, you were, Is that the scorpion that I'm thinking of? These parts that look like a drum, but then it looks like a motorcycle, and you're jumping on top of it, and it's got a microphone. It looks like you're riding a motorcycle. It looks like it's going to roll over and fall off or explode or kill you, and yet you're on there bouncing around. What is that?
Yeah, so way back when I was on drums, at some point I started singing, and we found a drummer to play live. And I told Dan, I was like, I don't really want to give up the drums entirely. So I took a kick drum with me, and I took a snare drum, and I put them sideways on legs. And I was like, they look just kind of rinky dink up here, though. I was like, can you do something to it? So he took all this metal and built a stand for them so that I could literally jump on top of them and pound on them and not be afraid that I'm going to break them every night. So that is that centerpiece. We call that Drumtron. That's our pet name for it.
Drumtron.
Yeah. And that's basically that piece is what locks into this catapulting pneumatic and airbag system that launches it into the air that Daniel built that locks into it. So it launches my drums into the air and they go sideways, and on the back panel of them, I'm actually standing. So I pull this arm up into the air and lock it into place. And that's when Daniel helped me create this idea, or he helped me create an idea that I had, turn it into real life and make it cooler than the original idea was, which was to DJ the band. I wanted to manipulate what they were doing with their instruments, just like a DJ in electronic music manipulates pre-recorded music. I wanted to manipulate live music. And so their guitar, or Mark's guitar and Dan's bass, are going through all these effects that I'm controlling with this thing we call the scorpion tail, with levers and buttons and all that. So it's like a
dubstep machine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because DJs are kind of boring.
You're so either... like,
not your kind of DJ, by the way.
Yeah.
Different kind.
Not taken the same way. You guys are either musicians or stars of house music or engineers for a Detroit auto company. I'm not quite sure what it maybe a little bit of all of that.
Yeah. All the above, yeah.
All of the above. Johnny, you have this amazing voice. I mean, when you get into the heavy stuff and you're screaming, I always find that a fascinating process, whether it's Dave Grohl or Paul McCartney or David Draymond of Disturbed fame. They can manipulate their voice so it can come out as a scream, but you have to know how to do that so you don't blow that voice out every night. And you also have the ability to go in these really melodic tones, which we heard a little example of in that last song. And I noticed in some of the videos, you take your forefinger and your middle finger and you put them on like your Adam's apple occasionally while you're singing. Why do you do that?
Yeah, basically because I started as a drummer since I was 7 years old. I'm a drummer at heart. That's my first love. I've always manipulated music with my hands. And when I started singing, my vocal proficiency was not nearly up to par. And so I started trying to manipulate my voice with my hands to get it to change certain notes or create vibrato. And I kind of did it as a joke at first. And I was kind of doing this yodeling effect by hitting my voice. And then our guitar player, Mark, was like, hey, you should actually try and mess around with that. Like, see if you can come up with something creative. And I was like, nah, that's dumb. I just kind of brushed it off. Then we went and saw this band called Fair to Midland. They were a band from Texas that we used to tour with. And the singer did something different but similar, where he'd grab his throat and he'd wiggle it sideways, whereas I kind of hit my throat and wiggle it back and forth, front to back. And I saw that he was actually doing musical things with it. And so I kept it in my vocals toolbox as just one of many tools. So I have the natural vibrato, from my gut like any singer does, and then I call this mechanical vibrato. It's just quicker, sharper. It has a slightly different tone than if I do it with my diaphragm.
It's really cool. Nice. I wanted you started, as you mentioned, as a drummer, and I think you got your parents took you to a show when you were like 7 years old. I think it was a Christian show or Christian rock show. That's where you got your love of percussion and drums. And so you're comfortable in that drum spot, and that's where the band began. But when you came out from behind the drum kit to be a front man, you spoke of the vulnerability and you didn't have the drum kit to hide behind anymore, and the fear. I found it fascinating on this record that you use a voice that I had not heard in 20 or 30 years. He was sort of like Eckhart Tolle, who's a very known writer now, speaks about the power of now, and a great philosopher, has written a lot of books. This gentleman from the 60s was called, is named Alan Watts, and he would do this philosophy. We used to run it at the station I started in San Francisco, and this station used to run it when I was just starting here doing the overnights, and the guy would just talking and the philosophy of life, and it would go on for half an hour. And I've been doing meditation for years and doing a lot of Zen stuff, and I had no clue what he was talking about. But I always wanted to get what he had to say, and I swear to God, I hadn't heard him since I started listening to this record. And I go, where's that voice? I know that voice. Holy S, it's Alan Watts. And I just queued up this little piece because it relates to what we were just talking about, the fear aspect.
Yeah.
He speaks about it in this little piece. And when he talks on the album, it goes into different songs. But this is a cool moment. I just want to get your take on this little moment of him speaking.
You'll find, therefore, that if you get with reality, all sorts of illusions disappear. But you must remember that the secret to all this is not to be afraid of fear. When you can really allow yourself to be afraid, and you don't resist the experience of fear, you are truly beginning to master fear. But when you refuse to be afraid, you are resisting fear. And that simply sets up a vicious circle of being afraid of fear and being afraid of being afraid of fear.
The words of Alan Watts, I really love that particular passage because we're all afraid of something, and facing your fears is tough for you as coming out behind the drums. But what about Alan Watts grabbed you guys that wanted to have you insert it at various points in this record, like at that spot?
Man, first off, that's really cool to hear that whole backstory to your connection with Alan Watts and all that on radio. And but yeah, man, it was something that I stumbled across on YouTube, actually. You know how the YouTube rabbit trail where there's like suggested videos in that little sidebar, yes. And then I click on one and there's another suggested video, another one. I really love that. I've gone down many rabbit trails with that. And I think at the time I was actually listening to Eckhart Tolle maybe, or someone in that realm, philosophy, self-help, you know, life kind of stuff. And Alan Watts was just somebody I stumbled across, and something about his voice, it has such a classic, I don't even know how to describe.
Almost hypnotizing.
Yeah.
Hypnotizing.
Yeah, there's an essence to it.
There is something, epic about his voice. And so it kind of drew me in. And at first it was just, he was just going on and on about stuff, and I didn't really absorb much of it. I was just interested by his voice. And so it started from there. And then I started listening to his stuff while I'd go exercise or, you know, do tasks around the house. I just have my headphones on listening. And then some of the things he said were just lining up so perfectly at that time with things that were going on in my life. Long story short, my mom got cancer and had basically a 99% death rate of this cancer that she got. So it was basically a death sentence. And at this time, she was becoming more and more religious in light of that, and I was becoming less and less. And so we were very close, but in that regard, our basic attitude towards reality or being itself was differing so drastically that felt like we were splitting in this weird way. And so when I came across Alan Watts, it almost was the perfect reconnection with reality while still being very non-religious. And taking it from there. So he took me down a path, and I'll forever be grateful. So I wanted to share that with the world, nuggets that I've come across in his talks. Because I felt like he's like a really best kept secret.
Yeah. Did the rest of you guys like it? Did it work for you?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I grew up, Johnny and I both grew up in the church, and it was something, you know, I was into and kind of gave it my all. And as I got older and just really started to think on my own about things, there were just all these questions and all these just kind of things I didn't like that people would just chalk so much up to, you know, oh, it's Jesus or oh, it's just God, you know. And then I was like, no, there's like more to it. Like we have to be able to understand a lot of things and not just like throw it under this rug of God or Jesus or, you know, and Jesus was becoming less of an X-Men figure too. I didn't like magic Jesus, you know, it's like, I can't relate to a guy that, you know, was born without, you know, sexual urges or something, you know.
I had 11 years of Catholic school. So
yeah, so you get it. But yeah, Alan watched it. He really like turned everything into physics, you know, and he didn't, I don't know, he just explained so much in every way that I needed to hear anyway. And I feel like a lot of people do, you know, as far as, you know, the benefits of religion, you know, helping you conquer fear and things like that and letting go and living in the moment. He really just makes it make sense, you know, like relating fear to like a feedback loop, you know, just like a microphone would have. It's like, that's what people need to hear. Not, you know, it may, I don't know, it just clicks.
Well, it just doesn't speak to music, though. It speaks to everyone's life because we all have blocks. And I think if we have the courage to face them, they're not often as bad as we think if we dive in and face them or maybe get help to face them if need be. But this is a really amazing record. And I love that he is interspersed throughout it. It's called The Stories We Tell Ourselves. It's not exactly new. It's been out since September. But this band is still touring behind it and making a lot of fans around the country happy. Their name is Nothing More. And our great pleasure to speak with Daniel Oliver and Johnny Hawkins, who will be at the TLA tonight, along with Mark and Ben. Ben Anderson is your current drummer. So great to talk to you guys, and thanks for stopping by.
Yeah, absolute honor and pleasure to be here, man. One of the last great, you know, music stations.
Well, so cool.
We're blessed that we get to turn 50, thanks to the friendship and love of our listeners over the years, as I told you off the air, of the generations. That's not something most rock and roll stations get to live through.
No.
You know, and continue to play all kinds of different music. Like, you've been described as a hard rock band. Now, some people call you new metal. Some people call you this. You're a great rock and roll band, you know, and I don't think you need to say anything more. People want a description that's more specific, but you're nothing more. And I don't think you need to say anything more than that. Great pleasure to see you guys.
Thank you
so much. It is 93.3 WMMR, and this is Nothing More.
I don't know what you had in mind, but here we stand on a pole.